Welcome to UN Calling Asia from the United Nations in New York. I'm Daniel Dickinson. Later in today's program, the Maldives tackles climate change and the IMF as peacekeeper in India. But first, the time has come for phasing out sanctions on Iran in order to protect the most vulnerable members of society, a leading human rights investigator has said. Idris Jazairi, who's the UN's first independent expert on human rights and sanctions, insisted that in Iran's case, punitive measures alone had not forced the country to the negotiating table to agree a deal on its nuclear program. Ahead of his first report to the UN Human Rights Council in September, Mr. Jazairi explained to Daniel Johnson what he hoped to achieve in the new position.
The hope of this mandate is that now that the process of diplomacy and negotiation has been started, there would be a phasing out of sanctions, which is a recognition of the failure of diplomacy.
So there isn't a sense that, as some people are saying, these sanctions are what brought Iran, for example, to the negotiating table. You'd refute that?
In the case of Iran, sanctions alone would not have solved the problem. But one must recognize that there's been a convergence between the imposition of stiffer sanctions on the one hand and a spectacular drop in the price of oil on the other. The combined effects of these two factors, the pincer effect, I would say, has had a very damaging effect on the economy of Iran, and in particular on the most vulnerable population groups in Iran, including women, children, people suffering from cancer, etc.
Do you get to visit these countries, the countries that you're interested in as part of your new mandate? And I should say you are the first special rapporteur on international sanctions.
Yes, I have already received an invitation to visit Sudan, which has been one of the targeted countries by international sanctions. My concern is not to discuss the politics of sanctions, but rather to address the adverse impact of what we call unilateral coercive measures on the most vulnerable groups, as I said there.
And you're going to be doing that with the presentation of your first report at the next Human Rights Council session in September. Can you give us an insight into your recommendations?
I will be pointing out the necessity to get a clearer picture of what these sanctions are. I know that there are about 32 targeted sanctions by the US, and I know there are about 37 by the EU. I know that the Security Council itself applies about 16 targets of sanction. We must remember also that there are many other cases of sanctions by individual countries which are not as transparent. I have written to member states applying sanctions and have asked them to send me the list of their sanctions. Unfortunately, I have not gotten a response.
The Maldives is making strides in confronting challenges such as climate change and achieving gender parity, according to the UN. Located in the Indian Ocean, the island nation has been described as ground zero for monitoring the impact of climate change. Shoko Noda is resident coordinator for the UN Development Programme in the Maldives. She told Deanne Penn how the UN is supporting what she called this young democracy.
I think people have seen a lot of photos from the Maldives of blue ocean, but when you are in the country, in the capital, it's quite different. Climate change is a big challenge in the Maldives. Gender inequality is another issue.
Give us examples of how UNDP works with the Maldives.
Well, first, when I say climate change or vulnerability to climate change, it's all about water. Either they have too much water because of the intense weather and intense rain, or because there's no water. The dry season is longer. So they have to harvest water, rainwater. They have to also use groundwater, better so that during the rainy season they capture the water and then during dry season they use it in a more sustainable manner. Coastal erosion is another issue, so UNDP is working with the communities to put the protection system on the ground. At the same time, people have to change their living style, so we're working with the community to come up with the community-based disaster risk management plans.
Could you tell us a little about the work that you're doing on the issue of gender equality?
Mm-hmm. So the Maldives is doing actually quite well on gender when you look at the aggregated data. The countries attained gender parity in primary and secondary enrollment, and the number of Maldivian women attending the university is at par with men. But when you look at the political decision-making level, there's only 6% of women in both national and local parliaments. UNDP is working closely with women's organization, also election commission, to encourage the future female political leaders.
And Ms. Noda, I believe you're coming up to the end of your first year as resident coordinator in the Maldives. Have there been any experiences or anything, any major events that have happened that have touched you in any way or any reflections that you would like to share?
Yes, the country is very, very beautiful and very dynamic. It's a young democracy that is still trying to struggle to find their own formula of democracy. I'm very optimistic for the future of the Maldives, and I feel very fortunate to be in the country.
Shoko Noda speaking to Deanne Penn. The building of infrastructure in India using public-private partnerships has been a mixed blessing, according to the International Monetary Fund, or IMF. Huge public projects have been built over the past decade, such as highways and railway networks, with most of the actual work handled by private companies. However, the IMF says because these firms typically focus on making profits, the partnership could sour if legal disputes arise. Rajiv Lal heads a private company that manages money for some of India's biggest infrastructure projects. He participated in a recent panel discussion on investment at the IMF in Washington, D.C. in the U.S. Mark Betancourt asked Mr. Lal why governments need private sector help in building public projects.
The theory is that the private sector is better at implementation, construction, financial structuring, and all of that. And so you invite the private sector to actually build the asset, then own and operate it over a concession period. In order for that to happen successfully, you need other kinds of capacity for administration and management and dispute resolution. So unless that is available, just raising the money is not enough to solve the problem.
And so what do you think is the solution to that? Is there, what's the sort of political mechanism that can be brought about to close that capacity gap before you even really start to try to apply those funds to projects?
Well, yeah. Well, so nothing is perfect. So, you know, you can't wait for one to start doing the other. So in India, we've started financing these projects, and now we are soft skills to manage that scale of project development by the private sector in infrastructure is catching up with the harsh reality of having built these assets and gotten into trouble with all kinds of disputes and all of that. So as that capacity to adjudicate and regulate catches up, I suspect that we'll have to clean up some of the mess that has been the ancillary impact of this rapid growth in private participation in infrastructure. We'll learn from that and lick our wounds and hopefully leap forward to the next level.
Something you proposed during the panel was this idea of sort of front-loading a lot of these projects onto the public side.
Yes.
Where the sort of major assets that are going to be used for public infrastructure get, I guess, built in the first place by the government, and then private companies can come in later and, I guess, manage them or exploit them to the fullest.
So they can contract a private party to actually build a project for them. But the cost and all of that, the management of all that remains government's risk. And they don't have to take it, as in government agencies do not have to build anything.
Mark Betancourt speaking to Rajiv Lal. You've been listening to UN Calling Asia from United Nations Radio in New York. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Daniel Dickinson.